For I know that my Redeemer liveth, and that he shall stand at the latter day upon the earth. This is one of the most common epitaphs that we find on tombstones, gravestones in Scotland. I don't know if that's the case here, but I think every Christian would feel very comfortable with this as their epitaph. This is their last statement, their abiding word to this world when their own voice has fallen silent. I know that my Redeemer liveth. You know the story of Job quite well, I'm sure. Job had lost just about everything, his wealth, his family, his business, his every earthly blessing. And his friends came to comfort him, and poor comforters they were. They really began to debate with him the cause of his sufferings, and their main argument was, it's your sin. They had a very crude doctrine of providence. It was basically, if you suffer, you've sinned. All suffering is the result of personal sin. You get what you deserve. And Job, knowing that, yes, he was a sinner, yet also knowing the general integrity of his life, protested the injustice of this allegation, this accusation, and fought back against it, and yet made little or no headway. And so he comes to chapter 19 in response to, again, accusations in chapter 18, and he's basically saying, everybody hates me. Everybody's against me. In verses 1 to 5, he's saying, my friends hate me. In verses 6 to 12, he's saying, my God hates me. And in verses 13 to 22, he's saying, my family hates me. And he feels that this hatred is completely unjust. And so he goes through a number of different metaphors and word pictures to show how he feels in this situation. For example, in verse 6, he describes himself really as a trapped animal, a netted animal. Verse 6, God has overthrown me and hath compassed me with his net. In verse 7, he sees himself as somebody like a criminal accused in court. Behold, I cry out of wrong, but I'm not heard. I cry aloud, but there's no judgment. Verse 8, he describes himself as somebody who's trying to travel a journey, yet people keep blocking his path. He hath fenced up my way that I cannot pass, and he has set darkness in my paths. In verse 9, he says, I'm like a dethroned king. He has stripped me of my glory and taken the crown from my head. Then in verse 10, he says, I'm like a demolished wall. He's destroyed me on every side and I'm gone. He says, I'm like a chopped down tree. My hope was once strong and flourishing, but now my hope hath he removed like a tree. It's just been chopped down. He says in verses 11 to 12 that he feels like a besieged city. And all these troops are coming against him. And then maybe most painfully of all, in verse 18, he describes himself as a patriarch being mocked by children. And that was just about the worst thing that can happen in this very patriarchal society for this old, established, prestigious man to have little children coming up to him, Satan, despising him and speaking against him. And this is so coming in on top of him and overwhelming him. He eventually cries out, have pity on me, verse 21. Have pity upon me, O my friends, for the hand of God has touched me. Why do you persecute me as God? You're not satisfied even with my flesh. And then he comes out with this fourfold desire for his words to be written down. He says it in four ways. Verse 23, "Oh, that my words were written. Oh, that they were printed in a book. That they were graven with an iron pen and laid in the rock forever." This is referring to an old procedure whereby words were carved out of rock and then filled with lead, which gave them a permanence and which sort of sparkled in the sun. He's saying four times, really, I just want a public testimony. He sees himself as dying, as his life ebbing away. He sees no way back, and his flesh is going, but he says, I want something to outlast me. I want this obelisk, this testimony, this stone to be left when I am gone. And this is what I want written on it. I know that my Redeemer lives. So he's actually even looking beyond the obelisk. He's looking beyond this stone of testimony that will outlast him, and he's looking to a champion who will outlast even that stone. He's looking towards his Redeemer. We'd like to look at this today under two headings. First of all, Job says, my champion lives. And on the basis of that, he says, I shall live also. Because he lives, I shall live also. So first of all, he says, my champion lives. Think of Job's situation here. He had no Bible. Most commentators and scholars reckon that Job was one of the earliest living people on the earth. Unlikely that he lived before the books of Moses were written. It's likely he had orally passed to him the gospel promise of Genesis 3:15, that one would come, a seed of the woman, who would crush the serpent's head. It's likely also he had the oral prophecies of Enoch that we read of in the book of Jude in the New Testament. Enoch also looked ahead and saw a time of judgment coming when the Lord would come with 10,000s of his saints to execute judgment and reestablish justice in the earth. But apart from these bits and pieces of God's word, he had no Bible. He had very little revelation. He also had no sense or feeling of God's favor. Everything said to him, as he describes here, God was his enemy. He had no blessings left, at least on an earthly level. His health, his wealth, his sons, his business, his property, gone. And he had, it would appear, no believing friends. His wife and his friends seemed to be far from having fellowship with him. He was alone and very, very lonely. And he's seeing himself dying as he's seen others die. And here, remember, he had no resurrection. He wasn't living in New Testament times. He hadn't seen Jesus perform resurrection miracles. He had no knowledge of the resurrection of Christ. He had so little. No Bible. No blessings. No believing friends. No resurrection. Everybody he had seen thus far had died and decayed and gone to dust. And yet, despite all this lack, all this absence, all this sense of loss, he says, I've got something that I'm not going to give up. He speaks of my Redeemer. Whatever else he lacked, he had this. He possessed a Redeemer. Now, this is a rich biblical word. As we'll see, a later revelation in the Bible really expands upon and fills out this word with significance and meaning. But it's unlikely that Job had the fullness of understanding of this term when he spoke it. It would appear from what we know of this word that it did speak of a close relative, somebody who was related. It also spoke of somebody that would come and champion the cause of the oppressed. But that's probably about all that Job knew. As we go through Revelation, we find, for example, in Exodus chapter 6, that God coming to Israel in Egypt is described as God being this Redeemer, and it's the same word. God coming alongside and delivering the oppressed. Then we find, as Moses develops this theme in Exodus and Leviticus, that this same word is applied to somebody who comes alongside a poor widow and who acts on her behalf to protect her from oppressors, whether it be buying back land that she'd had to sell off, or even marrying her in order to continue her family name and property. And of course, that's exemplified for us in the book of Ruth, isn't it? Boaz is given this title of Redeemer as he comes alongside this widow and champions her cause, who is this close relative who comes along and secures her land and secures her name and her title and her family and her property. And then later on, we find Isaiah picking up these words and speaking to Israel again of God being their Redeemer, and that they were to look forward to a great Redeemer to come, who would again come alongside, champion their cause, deliver them from oppression, purchase them back from slavery, and give back to them the land that had been taken from them. So it's a rich biblical word with huge redemptive significance, but Job didn't know all that at this point. What did Job know? Well, we find earlier in the book of Job is some vague hopes of a person like this appearing to help him. For example, in Job chapter 9 and verse 33, we read, "Neither is there any dazed man between us." He's speaking of how God had plunged him into darkness and fought against him. And he says, "And there's no dazed man between us. There's no mediator between us that might lay his hand upon us both." Job's looking out and he's saying, if only there was someone who could negotiate, who could mediate, who could arbitrate, who could lay a hand on me and lay a hand on God and bring us together again. Oh, if there was such a one. And that vague hope is developed again a bit stronger in chapter 16 and verse 19. Job says, "Behold, my witness is in heaven and my record is on high. My friends scorn me, but my eye pours out tears to God. Oh, that one might plead for a man with God as a man pleads for his neighbor." And he's beginning to pray here for this pleader, for this go-between, for someone who would champion his cause as somebody would for a poor neighbor. And then here in chapter 19, as it were, at Job's lowest point, we find these vague hopes, this mist, this fog clears. And he sees there is one. There is a mediator. There is a day's man. There is an arbitrator. There is someone who will champion my cause. And he speaks of him with such remarkable confidence. I know that my Redeemer lives. I know there is someone who will champion my cause. Here's me, utterly defeated, lost everything. Everyone saying to me, you're such a loser. And Job turns in the midst of that and says, no, I have a champion who's going to win my case, who's going to stand up for me, and who's going to defeat all my foes and all these false accusations. And it's not just a Redeemer or the Redeemer, it's my Redeemer. And it's very emphatic the way it's put in the original language. It's, I really know that my Redeemer lives. And if you go back through Job, you'll find the friends continually saying, we know this, and well, we know this, that Job, and well, we know this about you. Let us share our knowledge with you. And here's the conclusions we've come to, and here's the result of all our researches. Look at our great knowledge. And Job, as it were, looks at it all and says, I don't care what you know. Here's what I know. I know that my Redeemer lives. It's just remarkable. God-given, Spirit-wrought faith, hope, and assurance all rolled up into such a few words. It's interesting, too, if you look at these words. I know that my Redeemer liveth. And this could be put another way. It could be translated like this. My Redeemer is the Living One. And that's a title that's reserved for God alone in the Old Testament. It's a special Hebrew word. My Redeemer is the Living One. He's saying, my Redeemer is nothing less and no one less than God Himself. The very God that seemed to be His enemy, He turns around and says, that God, I'm not giving up on Him, and I know He's not given up on me. My Redeemer, my champion, my close relative that's going to come and plead my cause and win my case, He is no one less than the Living God. I know that my Redeemer is the Living One, and that He shall stand. Again, this looks to us in the English like just an ordinary word. We think, well, somebody's going to stand up. But again, this is a very special biblical word, which is often used in legal context, for somebody who stands as an advocate, somebody who's heard all the accusations and heard all the evidence and seen all the exhibits, and then stands up and begins to argue against the evidence and against the exhibits and against all the accusations. And if you read on, you'll notice it says, He shall stand at the latter day. And you notice there, day is in italics in our version, which means there's not a Hebrew word for that, but our translators have supplied the word to try and give us a better sense. But if you read it without that italicized word, it actually reads like this, He shall stand up as the last one. He shall stand up as the last one. Again, Job is looking here at a court scene, and he's heard all the accusations, one after another, after another, after another. And it seems there's no one who's listening to him as he protests and tries to argue his case, and it's defeated and argued against and defeated and argued against. And he's looking around, and at last his eyes alight upon someone who says, he calls, there's my champion. And he's going to stand up in this court, as the last word, with the last voice. He's going to speak in a way that no one can come back on, that no one can oppose and no one can argue with. He's going to speak in such a way that he will silence everybody else. He's going to stand as the last one, as the last word, as the last witness, as the last voice, and give the unarguable conclusion and verdict on my behalf. He shall stand. Notice too, it says, on the earth. Job's not just looking for a vindication in heaven. He sees there's going to be a vindication on this very earth, and it's literally on this dust. Remember, Job is in the dust here, and his flesh is about to turn to dust. And it's as if Job's saying that he's going to stand right here on this very dust I'm in the middle of, and that my body's going to be turned to, with all these allegations swirling around me. He's going to stand right there and he's going to vindicate me right here. He's going to speak here and clear my name and justify me from all charges. I know that my Redeemer lives and that he shall stand as the last upon the dust. Well, what remarkable faith, hope, and assurance based on such little threadbare, you might say, promises and truths that Job had. How much more do we have? We have Moses explicitly identifying this Redeemer as God. We have Moses describing even more what this champion does. He exacts vengeance on the oppressors of his people. He buys them back from slavery. He raises up their name again and vindicates them. And we have Isaiah promising that what God did in Egypt as Redeemer is going to be done in an even greater scale in the future. And then we have Jesus coming and saying himself, I've not come to be served, but to serve and to give my life a ransom for many, a redemption price for many. I've come to buy back many. Then you have Peter speaking of the Redeemer and his great redemption. With the precious blood of Christ, he says, we have been redeemed. You think of how much more truth we have. How many more verses we have to believe in. Can we not come to this place too and say, we have a champion. And I know him. And I know my champion is the living one. The Lord Jesus Christ, my close relative. The one who bonded with humanity in his own person. And who still has that humanity, who's still a brother in the flesh. A brother who is God, a brother who's paid the ultimate price, who's redeemed his people, who's redeemed me. And whatever the accusations and allegations that we hurl against ourselves, or that the devil hurls against us, or that a wicked world hurls against us, we know we have a champion. Someone is going to come in the midst of all our loss and all our defeats and win our case. One is going to have the last word. He's going to come into all our injustice and unfairness and say, he is mine. She is mine. Clear him of all charges. Vindicate her of all accusations. Justify them. And he's going to do it on this earth. Can you say, I know my champion lives? But on the basis of that, Job says, because he lives and he's going to do that, I shall live also. He goes on in verse 26, and though after my skin worms destroy this body. It's literally, though my skin be stripped off me. And he's really emphasizing here the horrors of corruption and decay to make what he's about to say even more glorious. He's saying, though my skin be stripped off me, yet in my flesh, and you can put that this way, from the vantage point of my flesh, from that vantage point, from the viewpoint of my own flesh, I shall see God. He's looking at this flesh that's about to just turn to dust, decompose at his own death. And he's saying, I'm not just going to see God with my soul. I'm not going to see him as a spirit merely. But I'm actually going to see him in this very flesh with these very eyes. Again, if we're to translate this very literally, we would put it like this. I myself will see for myself with my eyes. Four times he's saying, I, me, my. I myself will see for myself with my eyes. My Redeemer. My Champion. My eyes shall behold. As he says it again in verse 26, yet in my flesh shall I see God. If you look at verse 27, when he says, whom I shall see for myself, that means on my behalf, at my side or towards me. It's again speaking of this champion, not as someone who's out there, but who comes right beside him and stands right beside him and right with him, and who is towards him and who is on his behalf, whom I shall see for me, towards me, with me. I'll look and he's going to be right there, speaking and saying, Job is a godly man. Job is a saint. Job is clear of all these allegations. Let me explain to you what's going on here. These sufferings are not about Job's sin. Let me tell you what Job couldn't see, and let me tell you what his friends couldn't see. Let me tell you about Job chapter 1, what this is all about. This is not about Job. This is a wrestling match between heaven and hell, between God and the devil. This is not so much about Job's character, but about God's character. And this is Satan has come to God and he said, God, no one trusts you. The only reason they do is because you give them good things. Look at Job. What an aspersion to cast in God's character, that people only like him for what they can get from him. And so God says, take him and test him, and I'll show you why people really love me. And so Satan goes and does his worst. And here Job says, I know there's somebody going to stand beside me one day and tell the true story. He's going to tell the true facts. And he's going to clear my name and he's going to vindicate me. He's going to stand right beside this flesh and say, this man is mine. Leave him alone. Every Christian can look forward to that vindication, that justification, that clearing of all charges. He's going to stand right beside us, put his arms around us. He's mine. She's mine. Silence hell. Silence devil. Silence world. I won't hear another word against them. Silence conscience. Unashamed to own as his own. You'll notice verse 27 says, I shall see for myself, and my eyes shall behold, and not another. Again, literally, it's not as a stranger or not as an enemy. That's how he's described God at some of his lowest points. He's seeing God at times as an enemy, as an archer that's shooting at him. And he says, I know I'm going to see him, and it won't be like that. It won't be as a stranger. It won't be as an enemy. It'll be as a friend. And as he thinks about this, as he thinks, my Redeemer, I shall see him. And I shall see him in this very body. And as he thinks about how he will be vindicated and cleared. How does he climax this? He says, well, in our version, it's though my reins be consumed within me. And again, notice though is in italics, the slanty writing. So take that out and see the words that are in the original alone without that help for us to understand it. And it's literally my reins or my kidneys are consumed in my innermost being. You think, well, that's not much of a climax. What does that possibly mean? Well, for the Hebrew in that culture, the kidneys were the seat of their emotions. We would speak of the heart probably. But they spoke of the kidneys, the bowels, as being their innermost being, the deepest parts of them, the seat of their emotions. And he's saying here, as he thinks about this, as he thinks about his Redeemer and his redemption, his champion, and his ultimate case being ultimately won, he says, my innermost being is overwhelmed. It could be translated faints. He's almost passing out with the exhilaration of the anticipation. As he looks ahead to this great end, he's saying, it's too much for me. I can't bear it. It's just earth-shattering, soul-consuming truth. And so he turns to his friend and says, why are you persecuting me? Because the root of the matter is in me. I have true faith. I'm not a hypocrite. It's not all external. The root of true godliness is within, whatever else is seen and heard without. Because he lives, I shall live also. What assurance, what confidence. And notice it's Redeemer-focused assurance. Job has no hope when he looks in himself or at his circumstances. There's nothing there that's saying, Job, you're a believer. But when he looks to his Redeemer, when he looks towards his champion, that's when faith begins to build and hope begins to grow and assurance begins to stabilize him. It's Redeemer-centered assurance. That's where we get our assurance ultimately, by looking to our champion. Does assurance fluctuate? You only need to read Job to see that. There are two or three areas in Job where the assurance flowers and flourishes, but the vast majority of it, he's in the depths and he's discouraged and he's doubting. So assurance fluctuates, but it's when he gets to his Redeemer, it stabilizes. It cements itself. And this assurance builds hope in him for the future. assurance makes him long for the future, for heavenly glory. And it enables him to witness boldly in front of all his accusers. He's able to say, I know that my Redeemer lives. And he shall stand as the last word on this dust. And though my skin be stripped off me, yet in this flesh I will see God, whom I'll see acting for me right beside me, and not as an enemy. May God give his dear people here today such confidence and assurance as they come to his table to remember and think upon this great Redeemer. Amen. May God bless his word to us.